Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judges Larkin, Roden, and Frisch, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning, everyone. I would normally say please be seated, but I'm all seated at this point. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals this 20th day of May 2020. We have one oral argument on our calendar this morning. We are hearing the argument via WebEx. We appreciate the attorney's willingness to participate in this form of argument during these trying times so we can all keep our caseloads moving forward. So thank you for that. Everything will be the same as it has been. Each attorney will have 15 minutes to present her primary argument. Appellant's counsel will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. The marshal will hold up an iPhone that displays our makeshift timer, so be mindful of that. And the only other suggestion I have is, I think it is somewhat difficult to know when a judge wants to ask a question. I found that judges simply raise their hand. So if you all could just pay close attention to the judges, and if you see somebody with their hand up, maybe stop talking when you get to a break so I could acknowledge that person and we could have a question. Does anybody have any questions going forward? Then I will call the case for hearing. It is State of Minnesota versus J.L.L. Jr. Would counsel for appellant please introduce yourself for the record and begin argument.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Lucine Hoppe, and I am representing the appellant whose name has been abbreviated as J.L.L. in these proceedings. My client appeals an order of the district court denying him statutory expungement under Minnesota Statute 609-03. The court below found that my client was convicted and sentenced under Section 609-631, Subdivision 4-3B, which is not an enumerated felony eligible for statutory expungement under the current statutory scheme. To sentence under that subdivision, it requires a prior conviction within 5 years prior to the conviction for which the individual is to be sentenced. Our argument is that appellant was not, in fact, sentenced under subdivision 4-3B because there was no qualifying predicate offense on which to base that sentence. So because the court abused its discretion by making an erroneous interpretation of law, we're requesting this court vacate the district court's order as to the statute only and grant that my client that expungement relief under the statute. As the court knows, this makes a difference because of the ability then to expunge the records of the executive branch. So in my argument, and please feel free if you have questions at any time, I'm happy to answer them. But first, I'm going to summarize why the district court erred in finding that the statute is ambiguous. Then I'm going to discuss why, even if, say, you would find that the statute is ambiguous, the district court's statutory construction was erroneous.
Counsel, it looks like Judge Rodenberg has a question.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I'll pay close attention.
No, that's okay.
I do. Here's my question of you. I understand, and you make a good argument with respect to whether the plea that was entered was sufficient to qualify for a conviction under 609-631 sub 4-3B. But if the appellant was not convicted under that section, which is the only charge contained in the complaint, and the plea petition recites that he's pleading guilty to count one, under what section was he convicted in your view?
Yeah, so I think there was, in any view here, there's sort of a sentencing error that had to have occurred. So under that statute, let's say there was a conviction under subdivision 4-3A. That applies to offering checks in an amount totaling more than $250. That can apply because the check here was $200. Subdivision 4-3B requires that the appellant had the predicate conviction within 5 years, and that's not the case here, as I've been arguing. Subdivision 4-4 only allows for a sentence to imprisonment for up to 1 year, and here he received a 3-year stay of execution on a 17-month sentence. However, when you look at what he actually pled to and the underlying facts in the plea colloquy, really subdivision 4.4 best fits his plea colloquy and matches the elements of that the best, in which case I would argue he was simply sentenced erroneously.
Yes. My follow-up, though, is I don't see that subdivision mentioned anywhere in the file until I get to your brief.
Yeah, so, you know, this is an odd case where, you know, from my reading, the charging document clearly focuses on subdivision 4.3b. But when you look at the plea colloquy and actually what the court entered, there's no reference to what subdivision the actual conviction was under. The conviction itself was under at the plea colloquy. It seems strange to me as a defense attorney that there wasn't something specified during the plea colloquy as to what exactly statute he's pleading to. But that wasn't clear from that. And my argument is that to be convicted under 4.3b, he would have had to have that predicate conviction. I think what he actually ends up pleading to, if you look at the actual facts, is he ends up pleading to a subdivision 4.4 offense, and that is what he actually pled to and would have been convicted of. Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, the problem I'm having with your argument is mainly procedural, and that is this. We're here on a petition for expungement, yet you're raising what appears to be a challenge to the validity of the underlying conviction. And that is a challenge that would need to be made in a separate post-conviction proceeding. I mean, does your argument require us, in order to grant relief, to set aside the conviction?
No, Your Honor, this is not a collateral attack on his conviction. We are not trying to withdraw his plea or have him resentenced. What we are simply arguing is that what he actually admitted to at his plea hearing did not, in fact, amount to a conviction under subdivision 4.3b, that it was actually a conviction under sub 4.4 or another statute which would match the elements that he pled to. Since there
That sounds like a challenge to his conviction to me. That sounds like someone saying, I shouldn't stand convicted of this offense because my proffer at the guilty plea hearing is not adequate to support a conviction under that statute.
Well, I completely understand your question, Your Honor, and I think that is, you know, one of the most pertinent questions here. My response is that as a criminal defense attorney, I often end up going to a plea hearing, making a deal, and the my client ends up getting sentenced to something that was not in the original complaint, that he ends up pleading to a lesser charge, and here, or a different charge. And here, we don't have any evidence in the underlying documents that shows exactly, there's no recitation at the end, you know, of the plea colloquy, therefore you are convicted under subdivision 4.3b. So I'm arguing he wasn't actually ever properly convicted under 4.3b. He was actually convicted under 4.4, which is one of the statutory references that, you know, for which statutory expungement is allowed according to the statute. I think there's, you know, I just want to talk a little bit, and I understand, you know, those facts are unusual. But I want to talk about, you know, what the district court did as well here and the errors that the district court made. And I think there are really law going on here. The first is that, you know, the statute that the state and the court found that he was convicted under is not ambiguous. I think it could hardly be more clear. It uses the wording specifically of conviction to conviction. So the statute itself states a person who is convicted under subdivision 3 is subject to imprisonment for not more than 5 years or to payment of a fine of $10,000 if the forged checker checks are used to obtain or an attempt to obtain property of no more than $250, that's prong one, and the person has been convicted within the preceding 5 years for an offense under this section. So the time period during which the sentencing provision is applied runs from the date of the prior conviction to the date of the current conviction. The court, in reaching its decision below, held that that language, the court said specifically it was somewhat ambiguous. However, the court doesn't actually explain what particularly it found ambiguous about that conviction to conviction language. What the court did is just say that it was somewhat ambiguous, and then it moved to what was sort of an analysis of the canons of construction. But the court really only examined or mentioned one of the seven factors that, you know, the legislature asked the court to use when determining a statute's meaning. It focused solely on the consequences of a particular interpretation. And under, basically the court said they found that our interpretation of conviction to conviction for the purposes of the sentencing enhancement would be an absurd interpretation. We don't think that's the case. And in fact, you know, to get to sort of this ambiguity ruling, the court would have to see that there were actually two reasonable interpretations of the statute. So it's a little inconsistent, but I also think that the reason that the court found it absurd is the reason it gave was that it said that it would put, you know, insert some ambiguity into the law whereby the defendant could sort of game the system by trying to stretch out the proceeding so that the conviction goes beyond the 5-year look back period to his prior conviction. You know, and while in theory that may be true, and you know, the court goes to kind of an extreme example of, you know, somebody who leaves the country and stays out for 5 years just purposely to try to avoid the sentencing enhancement. I think those are really theoretical, and I think they ignore the fact that, you know, prosecutors aren't completely defenseless with respect to a defendant that's trying to delay proceedings and can certainly address that. I don't think that ambiguity. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Your Honor.
Could you just clarify me, what do you think he was convicted of? Which subdivision?
So what according to his plea and the elements in the plea, it appears to me he was convicted under subdivision 4-4. That subdivision is a gross misdemeanor that does not have that sentencing enhancement applied for the 5 years from the date of the 2008 conviction. Go ahead.
So that offense, the actual service is no more than 250 and no prior, but he had a prior, correct?
So he had a prior, so the prior that, I'm sorry, said he had a prior, so are you talking about the 5 year prior related to the 2008 conviction?
Hold on a second. Let me, Judge Rodenberg, ask your question while I take a closer look at this, please.
Thank you. I understand the argument that his plea may not have been sufficient to satisfy all of the elements of 631 sub 43B. But it's hard for me to believe that Judge McManus would have taken a plea to a gross misdemeanor offense and sentenced him to 17 months in the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, you know, Your Honor, I think that any way you look at this, the sentence doesn't seem to have been appropriate, as I mentioned earlier in the argument. And, you know, I don't know what happened there, but I think that it's possible the state intended for 43B and the parties proceeded thinking that possibly 43B was what he was pleading to, but that's not what he ended up pleading to because he doesn't satisfy the conditions. I'm sorry, Judge Larkin, go ahead.
You keep saying he doesn't satisfy the conditions, and are you saying that's because he doesn't have a prior felony or that he doesn't have the prior felony within the appropriate time frame?
He doesn't have the felony within the appropriate time frame. He does have a 2008 conviction.
That brings me back to my initial question. You are unavoidably challenging the validity of his plea. If you're asking us to ignore the fact that he received a felony sentence and conclude that he actually pleaded guilty and was convicted of a gross misdemeanor, you're really saying that his conviction's invalid. He shouldn't be convicted and have a 17-month sentence. He shouldn't be convicted of a felony. So I don't know how you can do that here in an expungement case. My other concern is, I mean, if the argument is, well, the elements are satisfied by what he admitted, et cetera. I mean, we have case law that says even where the proffer at the guilty plea hearing is not perfect, we can look to the complaint and we can conclude that the person was in fact admitting guilt to the offense charged in the complaint. So I'm having a hard time, one, understanding why we should be considering whether or not, or what he was convicted of, whether he was validly convicted of a felony. Because at the end of the day, I think the law says your offense level of conviction is based on the sentence you received. He received 17 months. That's a felony level sentence. That means he was convicted of a felony offense. If what you're arguing is he shouldn't have been sentenced to 17 months, he shouldn't have been convicted of a felony, then you're challenging his conviction, which is a collateral attack, which is not permissible in an expungement proceeding.
You know, we're not challenging, we're not, you know, asking the court to overturn his sentence.
But you're asking us to overturn his felony conviction and hold that it was a gross misdemeanor.
Well, we're asking the court to acknowledge that he didn't plea properly under 4.3b, and that really the conviction that would apply here would be either a 4.4 or some other conviction that fits the plea of the offense, and that the district court's analysis of the statute was incorrect.
Looks like your time is up. You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the state. Would you please introduce yourself for the record and begin your argument?
Sorry about that. May it please the court. My name is Anna Light. I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. I do just want to note for the court that I'm not able to have the grid view on the video, so I may not be able to see your hand raised, so please feel free to just interrupt me if I don't see you. The district court acted well within discretion when it denied appellant's petition for statutory expungement, but I will note that it did grant judicial expungement under its inherent authority. But simply put, the legislature decided to exclude appellant's conviction from eligibility under the expungement statute. Contrary to appellant's arguments, it is clear from the record that appellant was convicted under subdivision 4.3b of the check forgery statute, and the legislature very clearly in 609A did not list subdivision 4.3b as being eligible for expungement under the statute. The parties agree, we agree that he was convicted of offering a forged check in the amount of $200 and that he was sentenced to a felony level offense of 17 months. Therefore, under the facts of the case, and as you can see from the petition to plead guilty and the sentencing document that he had to have been convicted under subdivision 4.3b. I think, you know, in this expungement context, I agree with Judge Larkin that the analysis really ends there. Chapter 609A authorizes certain felonies to be eligible for petitioning for expungement. And if appellant's conviction isn't listed in the statute, the petition isn't even authorized to be brought. So if the appellant has an issue with believing that he was illegally sentenced or that his conviction should be overturned, that should be brought in a separate proceeding, either through post-conviction or motion to correct sentence. But Judge Rodenberg?
Is there an available, that you're now reaching a subject that concerns me. Is there an available avenue by which appellant can reach the question of the validity of his conviction at this point, given the passage of time, even if his conviction was improper, and it seems it may have been.
Well, I would dispute that I do not believe that it was improper, and we can certainly discuss that. But I do believe, you know, case law says that you can bring a motion to correct an illegal sentence at any time. And that might not, that isn't necessarily barred by a normal post-conviction time bar.
So in other words, he could make, it's your view that he might be able, not that I'm not asking to concede the point, but he might be able to make a motion under the rules for correction of sentence.
I would posit that that would be the appropriate forum to have the discussion of whether his sentence was actually illegal or not.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So the appellant asserts that he was actually convicted under subdivision 4-4, which is a gross misdemeanor conviction. As Judge Rodenberg pointed out earlier, you know, that just doesn't compute with the sentence that he was given of 17 months. It also doesn't align with what is included in the petition to plead guilty, which clearly says he is pleading guilty to count one in the criminal complaint. And the criminal complaint explicitly, clearly identifies subdivision 4-3B as what the charge is. And he clearly pled guilty to that offense. So really, you know, my argument is that the analysis ends there. I don't have much more to say as far as what should be decided in this expungement proceeding. If the judges would like me to get into the statutory interpretation of 609.631, the check forgery statute, I'm happy to have that discussion. But if the panel doesn't have any other questions or doesn't feel that that's a relevant topic for this appeal, I'm happy to yield my time. Judge Larkin?
Counsel, I just want to make sure I understand the position of the state. So the situation is, we unfortunately do not have a judge who said, I accept your plea to Minnesota statute, yada, 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 convicting you under that statute. So we don't have an express recitation of the statutory subdivision to which he pleaded guilty and under which he was found guilty. But the complaint alleged a particular subdivision, and his factual basis, at least as he proffered it, purportedly satisfied that subdivision, and the district court sentenced him in accordance with sentencing under that subdivision. So we just would sort of say, well, given all those circumstances, the reasonable conclusion is this is what he was convicted of. For the purposes of an expungement proceeding, that's not eligible for expungement. If he wants to argue, I shouldn't have been sentenced that way because my plea was to a different subdivision, that's properly post-conviction or motion for correction of sentence.
Correct.
Understood. Judge Rodenberg. Can't hear you.
I'm just playing with my hands. I wasn't trying to raise one. I also just realized I didn't put my robe on for this WebEx conference, and I apologize for that to all.
You look very judicial in your chambers, nonetheless. Not to worry.
I didn't even notice your eyes.
Does the panel have any more questions for the state?
I have none. Thank you.
All right, rebuttal argument?
Yes, Your Honor. I very brief. I just wanted to point out, you know, there are other felony statutes, like the felony forgery statute 609.63, which, you know, are imprisonment up to 3 years for behavior that I think his plea actually would sustain. And I think that just assuming that his conviction was for a statute that doesn't actually fit the facts of the case, that's erroneous. And I think we can't assume, based on the record, that that was what his ultimate conviction was for. For instance, you know, the forgery statute talks about Sorry, I had it and I lost it. Using a false account or record relating to a business, it talks about using it for the purpose of identification or recommendation. There are other sections under the forgery statute that I think could apply here, and they are felonies. But mainly what I'm arguing is that I think what the district court did in its analysis below was incorrect, and that moving to a finding of ambiguity based on the statutory language was not the right way. Even if this court isn't inclined, on appeal to agree with, the argument that we're making here, I think it should remand back to the district court to make further findings regarding the record and what his actual conviction was for, since the court didn't actually explore that when it found that the statute was ambiguous.
Counsel, can I make sure I understand your argument? When you say the record isn't sufficient to support a finding of guilt under 4B, does that require us to accept your argument regarding how to interpret the 5-year timing period?
It does, Your Honor.
And that's not an issue that's been definitively addressed in case law?
I was unable to find it. The state and the court cited some cases that they think were in their favor, but the language is actually different than the language that we have here in
so
all
your,
of those cases.
Your argument so requires two steps. We have to say, okay, first we agree with you regarding how to interpret the statute. If we don't agree with you, he has the requisite prior conviction. If we do agree with you, he doesn't.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
That's all. I thank you for your time today and for doing this in this strange period. I thanks for the court's attention.
Well, thank you. Thank you to both attorneys. The matter was well briefed and argued. It is submitted and you'll have our decision within the 90 days required by law. That concludes our oral calendar this morning. We have non-oral cases to hear next, and we'll sign off and tend to those. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.